Hi, folks. My name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual health, hormonal health, and genitourinary reconstruction. And welcome to Pearls and Perspectives. Today, I have the great Dr. Alex Tatum with us. Alex, say hello to the crew.
Hello, everyone. Amy, I'll pay you your $5 for that intro and a little bit later. But for the sake of our audience, my name is Dr. Alex Tatum, and I am also a board-certified urologist specializing in male sexual and reproductive medicine, currently in private practice with a large LUGPA group called Urology of Indiana here in Indianapolis. And I also serve as the corporate director of men's health for our larger private equity firm, US Urology Partners.
So, Alex, what does that mean?
It basically means I have a lot of Zoom meetings. But, you know, the whole idea behind private equity is being able to sort of copy and paste best practices so you can lean on the power of scale. And so I've been very fortunate that we've had a great men's health practice, you know, that's blossomed here since I joined several years ago. And basically being in this role gives me an opportunity to try and educate the other men's health leaders within our platform about what we do, why we do it. We collaborate on what best practices could be and help people try to elevate their practices as high and as far as they can go.
So today's discussion is not going to focus on that, but I want to delve into this a little bit more. What are some of the pain points? Because you really get into the weeds with all the different conditions that you treat. So what are the pain points in trying to get your colleagues to implement maybe some of the knowledge that you know?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge is, you know, people just have paralysis. They look at so many different projects and so many things that need to be done. And even whenever we first joined the private equity network, people kind of looked at my practice and they're like, we don't know where to start, right? Like, you know, you have all of these different irons in the fire. And, you know, I just tell them that the journey of a thousand steps starts with just one at a time. And so let's focus on one thing. So right now we are having a focus on prostate cancer survivorship. So what we're doing is we're having a meeting here in another week where we're all going to get on a call. I'm going to give a presentation talking about the value of prostate cancer survivorship from a clinical perspective. And then I'm going to get into the logistics. And we're going to talk about how you actually implement that. What resources are essential? What things do I have that maybe aren't essential? What are maybe some good ideas that I haven't thought of? And then what we do is we come up with an action item list for each practice that is then worked on between that men's health champion at that location, that physician, that clinician, and also with their COO, their operations team. And the goal is for them to slowly start checking away at things so that the next time we have a check-in, you know, a couple weeks or, you know, months later, they're just a little bit further and a little bit better. And it's just like weight training or anything else. Like you're only competing with yourself, right? Like, you know, obviously we all want to be the best we possibly can be, but every practice is different. What works for me may not work for somebody else, and they may have to tweak things a little bit. And we're just trying to create a brain trust so everyone can, you know, perform at their highest level.
Wow, I love that. That is a great explanation of what you do in addition to your clinical work. I love it.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, that hobby.
Now, on the topic of weight training, today's discussion is going to be on testosterone. It's interesting because when my patients come into my office, for many of them, when I ask them, what are you hoping to get out of today's visit or how can I help you? What would make today a successful encounter? A lot of them say, I want to maintain my muscle mass as I'm losing weight, or I want to gain lean muscle mass. I love when my patients say that. But unfortunately, that conversation doesn't really get a positive response, I suspect, in most healthcare settings. Because when someone comes in and says, I would like to gain muscle, what do we tell him? Maybe like eat less, move more, but go to the gym. But how do we help them as healthcare providers? When in reality, we can help our patients gain muscle. That is their nursing home prevention program.
Yeah. And I think that the problem is that people don't understand how valuable lean tissue mass, muscle is for their long-term, their longevity, but also their long-term quality of life. And like, absolutely, listen, we all want to feel comfortable, like with our clothes off, right? I mean, no duh. But we also want to be able to pick up our grandkids and we want to be able to do things on our own and not have to rely on assisted living. And the truth is that we all have the ability to gain muscle and to improve. But if we're talking about a physiologic limit, somewhere in like your 40s, right? Like it becomes really, really freaking hard to put on new lean mass, right? Without a lot of extra help. And that becomes an almost insurmountable barrier for our men that are in that age range or approaching that age range and also have low testosterone. Because it doesn't matter how well they eat, doesn't matter how much they train, they are going to hit a hormonal wall that they can't get over without our help.
Absolutely. So just for full transparency, I do want to disclose that both Dr. Alex Tatum and I are consultants for Marius Pharmaceuticals. They do have an oral testosterone product for which we are going to be discussing today. But I do want to make sure that people are aware that we do help out with some consulting work for that company. So why don't we begin by talking about, and actually I want to first tell people why I decided to interview you on this topic. Because even though we're like around the same age or a little bit younger, I remember our first discussion together was at the Sexual Medicine Society of North America meeting, probably about 6 or 7 years ago. I was in my first year of practice at the University of Iowa. You were in your fellowship with Dr. Larry Lipschultz at Baylor. And just knowing Dr. Lipschultz's practice, I knew that you had a wealth of knowledge and so much experience treating men with low testosterone. And I kind of looked at my background, and while I treated many people with low testosterone, in many ways throughout training, I didn't have like a mentor that was teaching me how to do it. I remember being at the VA where we saw, you know, our patients by ourselves, and we had like, you know, obviously oversight by an attending. But we didn't have an attending in the room with us when we were guiding our patients on testosterone therapy. And oftentimes in training, we see the patient for that visit. And every patient we see is a new visit because we never see them 3 months later, 6 months later to see, are we actually helping this person? That's one of the downsides of so many training programs is we don't have long-term care with our patients to know what's working, what's not. And so I remember sitting down with you, it was like right by the bar area. And I was like, Alex, what are you doing for testosterone? Like, I need like a place to start. And you gave me a starting regimen. And that's what I put a lot of my patients on at the University of Iowa. And I realized very quickly that my low T patients were my happiest patients compared to like in training when I wasn't really entirely sure what I was doing. I dreaded seeing the low T patients. And then once I was faculty at Iowa, if I had like 3 or 4 low T follow-ups, I knew today was going to be a good day.
It's great. It's great because, I mean, you know, those are, you know, level, like, you know, we joke in private practice, it's level 4 high five because you get a patient that previously had a fairly complex picture. If we're talking about, you know, all the other risks of insulin resistance, you know, sarcopenia, obesity, and, you know, all of a sudden you're able to add in just one, you know, agent, maybe two, if you're trying to control estrogen, and all of a sudden radically change this person's quality of life. I mean, there are few interventions that we have in medicine that can cause such a dramatic shift that well-done testosterone therapy can.
Mm-hmm. So the purpose of this discussion is going to be like a no-nonsense, real talk discussion, learning about what works and what doesn't work for patients. And given that there are so many ways of giving someone testosterone, I want to hear from you, how do you actually do it in real time? So to set the stage here, What is your personal and professional interest in testosterone? Why is it important to you?
Yeah. So I will tell you that I first really became fascinated with testosterone actually when I was interviewing for fellowship. And so I was interviewing. I was so nervous going into my interview with, you know, Larry, because like he's the legend, right? You know, and I really wanted to do his fellowship. But what I found was fascinating is that he had such a sophisticated understanding of the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, how it related to fertility. He had published and written most of the books on it. But then at the same time, he was also seeing these pretty complex patients on testosterone, and they were on regimens that I barely recognized. And some of them were on ancillary medications to control their estrogen, which was foreign to me. And, you know, he was adding in tamoxifen to control acute gynecomastia, and he was controlling prolactin with cabergoline. we were using other more exotic compounds like nandrolone, oxandrolone, oxymethylone, stanozolol, all of these different medications that are all cousins of testosterone that have the possibility for benefit when used correctly and judiciously. But it was just something that was like beyond my comprehension. It was kind of like, not only going from being deaf to not just, you know, hearing, but hearing a symphony. And I was like, I need to understand this. I have to come here. And I threw myself into fellowship. And as my buddy John Balin laughed at me constantly because we would joke as, you know, the testosterone is being like the dark side in the sense, because it takes a lot to kind of go into that realm of high dose testosterone, understanding it, understanding what the effects on lipids are, what does it do to cardiac risk, you know, to the liver whenever you're talking about oral agents. And I just dove in like head first and tried to teach myself everything I could. I was always picking Dr. Lipschultz's brain. I was talking to other experts, other people, reading the primary literature. And again, it was like learning how to play guitar. And you start to learn all these individual notes, and then you start to learn how to weave them together into chords, and then you start weaving them into melodies and harmonies. And it all comes from understanding these fundamentals and understanding how they all affect each other. But the end result is being able to profoundly alter physiology and athletic outcomes in patients with medications that, be honest, God, most of them are like, what, 40, 50 years old? Like, this is not rocket science in that sense. So that was my initial professional interest. And then, you know, personally, maybe for being a freaking workaholic, you know, ongoing, especially during my first few years of practice, I was diagnosed with low testosterone and I started, you know, on testosterone myself. And then I could see in real time, like, oh my gosh, like I aromatize like nobody's business. Okay. Like, you know, I take a tiny dose of test and all of a sudden like my estrogen goes through the roof. And so I have to walk the walk, right? Like I have to cut my dose down to, for a while I was doing Cipionate with, you know, more frequent dosing throughout the week and, you know, judiciously cutting up an AI and trying to manage that. You know, now I moved on, I'm lazy now. I've moved on to, you know, oral testosterone, Kysotrex for my personal management. But, you know, yeah, I have a deep personal and professional interest in advanced hormone management.
It's so nuanced. I mean, you're alluding to really the art that is hormone replacement therapy. And I think it's rare that we, during urology training, get a sense for what that nuance is, because we're never going to operate on someone for low testosterone. So as a trainee, I mean, we barely want to be in clinic. We usually want to be in the operating room with a scalpel in our hands. But it's, I think a lot of us are learning this information once we're done with training. Are there additional resources or people with whom you've spoken where you've learned a lot more of that nuance?
You know, I have really appreciated conversations that I've had with Abe Morgenthaler. I was actually just on the phone with him the other day, you know, talking about the philosophy behind testosterone replacement, you know, coming to grips with this issue of free testosterone. You know, should we even be looking at total T? You know, should we be only relying on free testosterone? If we have a patient who, let's say, has a quote unquote normal total testosterone, but we know that they're sarcopenic and they're going into another round of chemotherapy for their leukemia or whatever the case may be, and they happen to wander in our clinic, you know, yeah, I know technically by AUA guidelines, that guy doesn't have a total T less than 300 nanograms per deciliter, but I know from thousands of patients worth of clinical experience, I can put him on a generous dose of injectable Cipionate, maybe some other, you know, compounds in addition to that, and I can add a profound amount of lean mass and keep him healthy and much less likely to have a hip fracture or to have an unintended fall. And, you know, okay, that's outside of guidelines, but isn't that doing the right thing for the patient? And so I've appreciated insight from Abe, Jason Kovac, one of my, you know, he was a partner of mine when I first started. I appreciated some of that mentorship as well. And, you know, also like I talk and listen to my patients, you know, what works to them, like, because we prescribe these medications all the time. And so often we stop and we don't ask patients like, hey, your numbers are better, but how do you feel? Like, how you doing? You know, and that's taught me a lot as well.
So you mentioned testosterone cipionate, and that medication, what, it's the still to date the most commonly prescribed formulation worldwide. I can't think of another medication that came out like 50 years ago that is still the most commonly prescribed formulation. of a therapy. So I think that's a good place to begin. What percentage of your patients would you say are on that medication? And how do you know where to begin in terms of the dose?
Yeah, so I will tell you that still a large majority of my patients are on testosterone cypionate. And that's just because it's widely available, it's extremely cost effective, and it's clinically effective. You know, the drawback of cypionate is just that if you're going to manage it well, it does require a little bit of nuance. And for some patients, it's straightforward. You can start them on, let's say, a half cc, you know, a week, or 0.3 cc's a week, and they're ready to rock and roll, and that's it. But other patients, especially as obesity becomes more and more common, you know, we have to add in some aromatase inhibitors to combat, you know, aromatase, which is more prevalent in fatty tissue. And we have to keep an eye on our patients because a lot of them are getting started on GLP-1s and they would benefit from being put on testosterone sooner rather than later. And then they lose weight, which also means they start to aromatize at a lower rate. And then you're going to crush their estrogen, which puts them at risk of having, you know, creaky joints, you know, lack of sex drive, sexual, you know, side effects, and, you know, other things that we know are not good for having low estrogen. Estrogen is neuroprotective and cardioprotective. We need it in a healthy amount. So cypionate is probably the most common go-to, but I often tell other doctors it's like playing bass. Okay. It can be really, really simple, or just watch Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. You can make it as complicated as you can imagine. So, that's kind of where we start.
Yeah. You know, I'm always surprised by looking at testosterone levels on various doses of testosterone cypionate. I used to dose people a lot higher than I do now.
Yeah.
In terms of just like, I'm trying to minimize the need for an aromatase inhibitor or, you know, to treat testicular atrophy. So my dosing has changed. But I do have a lot of people that just feel better on a higher dose. And then I have people that do great with 0.4 cc's once a week. And then other people need a full cc, you know, once a week. Like, is there any way to know what dose someone is going to need? I haven't been able to figure it out.
So you can guess, okay, based off of lean muscle mass, okay? And so that'll give you like a rough idea. But also, I mean, the thing is that a guy, you could have two guys wearing the same size shirt and they have vastly different lean muscle mass and vastly different visceral fat. And so you're going to be doing a lot of guesswork in your average clinic. And so the rule of thumb that I tell other docs is, you know, start low because you can always go up and it's a lot easier to increase a dose than it is to be chasing down side effects. And I have found that I have moved more and more to smaller, more frequent doses in my patients to try and avoid the need for adjuvant therapies, and also to try and get things a little bit smoother for patients. Because although it is natural for our testosterone to do a yo-yo, it's supposed to do a yo-yo within 24 hours, not over the course of 6 to 7 days or more. So I even have a number of patients of mine who are actually on daily sub-Q cypionate injections, and they do great with that. Cypionate or enanthate. But yeah, there's a lot of flexibility with injectable esters.
You know, I've heard from patients before, and certainly from other colleagues, that they don't like the injections because of that roller coaster effect. And I've seen that before with patients, because during training, our common protocol was for them to inject cypionate every 2 weeks. And that's certainly within our guidelines. I don't follow that anymore because I realize it's, of course, they're going to have a roller coaster effect. That makes sense with the pharmacology of the medication.
Yeah, so the half-life is 8 days.
Yeah. Yeah. So I typically will dose once a week or twice a week, you know, like you mentioned. Yeah. Where do you typically start people if they're just starting injections? Would it be once a week, twice a week? Or you ask the patient, what are you interested in doing?
Yeah. So what I will do is, for most patients, I start once a week. All right. And I'm commonly looking at, you know, about 0.5 is being my baseline for the majority of patients. And then I can consider kind of moving that down or moving that up from there. If I have an older patient with less muscle mass, okay, that is someone where they probably don't need 0.5. They could probably do fine on 0.3 or 0.4. So let's go ahead and let's try it. Now, if I've got, you know, a well-muscled, you know, guy in his early 40s, then yeah, I'm going to start to move him up from there. And then we have to deal with the issue of frequency. All right. If someone is only on, let's say, somewhere like 0.3 or, you know, point, maybe even up to 0.5 cc's, you know, that's someone where, you know, they're probably going to be fine with a once a week dose in regards to polycythemia. All right. Because it's really those high highs that, you know, kind of bite you when it comes to revving up the bone marrow. And so I may not, you know, push that patient to do more frequent injections, but I may, when I have patients that need a more significant dose, I'm like, all right, buddy, I'm going to make you a deal. I'm going to give you a healthy dose of testosterone, but you're going to have to split it. Okay. And that way we are going to hopefully avoid those as peaks, or we're going to minimize them, and we're going to minimize your need for an AI and minimize your need for, you know, donating blood every so often. And most patients are pretty, they're pretty open to that. Once you show them how to inject, especially inject in their glutes, which is going to be your younger patients, it's fine. It's not a big deal.
Alex, I've been switching a lot of my patients from an intramuscular to a subcutaneous injection.
Yeah.
The patients tend to really like it, especially if they're injecting a smaller dose. What's your take on sub-Q versus IM?
Yeah, so sub-Q is totally fine. And I think that it is a great option, especially if you can get like a 27 gauge needle, and you can get like, you know, they usually come in half inch, but if you can find a 1 inch 27 gauge, that's actually nice, because you can do kind of a deep sub-Q, like, you know, shallow intramuscular injection in the glute. The challenge that I have found with the sub-Q injections in the belly, which tends to be where a lot of patients will go to, is that I don't know if it is, you know, just the cottonseed oil that most of these, you know, commercial products are coming in, but I have a lot of patients that get annoyed with little knots that won't go away very easily. And so for patients that have that risk where they can only inject in their belly, I'm going to bust them down into more frequent sub-Q doses. So maybe they're doing like 3 to 4 little microdoses sub-Q. They can even draw that up in an insulin pen. And what that's going to do is that's going to reduce the risk to develop those nodules. For guys doing higher doses, usually they're going to need enough space, to enough tissue to put that in. You're going to need to do intramuscular. But that isn't, physiologic dosing rarely requires that much oil.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting when we talk about injection technique and types of needles and locations, because that's certainly not something that we're taught in training. I remember like one of the most annoying things that I was going through when I was initially at the University of Iowa was ordering injection supplies. I was like, how do I know which needle to get and which syringe? Because oftentimes, like, I would have my nurses go into the room and they would teach my patients how to do the injection. And now that I have my own practice, like, I'm the person who teaches the injections. Yeah. And I've seen a lot of men who have previously been on injections, they didn't tolerate them. And when I bring them into clinic and I actually have them put a needle in and do an injection with the proper technique, all of a sudden it's a nothing burger. So
yeah.
Technique is everything with this.
Yeah, it really is. And I'll be honest, that's something that I didn't really understand until I had to just start sticking myself. And I was like, oh my gosh, like this is what works. This is what doesn't work. And so for the sake of our listeners, if you want to try and make your life easy and easy for your patients, what you want to do is every time you're going to prescribe testosterone, injectable testosterone cipionate, there are going to be 4 things that you order. The first is going to be your testosterone. All right. The second thing is going to be your syringe. I recommend 1 milliliter Luralox syringes just because they're easy to work with. And the smaller the syringe is, the less effort it takes to deploy the oil. I recommend getting 18 gauge draw needles. Okay. And you tell the patient, hey, the big needle, that's a harpoon. Don't stick yourself with that. That's what patients will draw the oil up in. And then they can swap that out for like a 20. If they're doing intramuscular, you can do either a 23 or a 25 gauge. Intramuscular, you're going to want about a 1 to 1.5 inch needle, 1.5 being a more common one for your 23s. And then if you're doing sub-Q, you can do either a 27 or a 30 gauge needle. And so that is a regimen that can work, that little system for either intramuscular or sub-Q. And that gets your patients what they need: a draw needle, an injection needle, a syringe, and the testosterone itself.
Yeah. So that's great advice because that's not in our guidelines. No one really teaches what supplies. I recommend a couple different ones. So I'll just go through that really quick. I did have one patient that was drawing up with an 18. And because it's such a big needle, he pushed some of the rubber stopper into the vial. And so that only happened once, but that was enough where I was like, maybe I'll just have them draw up with a slightly smaller needle because that needle is pretty big.
It is. It is. But I'm a horribly impatient human being, and so I just like transfer that on to all my patients. So, an 18 is a whopper, but probably a 21 is probably a little bit easier for people to draw up with. Or, I've even, I'm a masochist. I've probably injected more microplastics in me than anything I've ever consumed out of water bottles, because like I've even just used the same 23 I've drawn in just to inject myself because I'm lazy. Yeah, you're not wrong for going for a smaller draw needle.
So I'll just have my patients, I actually have them use a 3 mil syringe. And I think, I don't know, in my experience, sometimes when the thumb can be closer to the hand, sometimes it makes it easier for people to inject. So the syringe comes with this needle. It is hard to find a small needle to put on a syringe that's larger than a 1 mil. So even if someone would like a 27, let's say 5/8 inch needle, you can't really always find that online, at least not in my electronic medical record. So I,
No.
yeah.
And then you send it, and then the pharmacy doesn't have it. I
No,
can't
they
give it to the
always
patient.
give the wrong supplies.
I know. And then the patient's like, calling you, get a freaking hemorrhaging because they stab themselves with some giant garden hose, and you're like, oh God.
Yeah. So that's a big thing too, is even if we write the correct prescription, we have to make sure if our patients aren't tolerating it, we have to verify, hey, what needles and syringes do you have? And then for my patients doing sub-Q, I have them use a 25 gauge 5/8 inch needle, and it tends to work pretty well. But it all depends. I have people kind of tickle their skin a little bit because I realized this too when I was freezing my egg, then all of a sudden having to give myself injections. You know, after having put so many guys on injections, I was literally pacing around my place. I could not do it. I felt like a little baby because I could not just get the needle in. And what I realized is every area of the body has a different sensitivity to a needle. So if I'll tickle an area with a needle and if it feels like it's going to be painful, I go somewhere else where I don't feel it at all. So I have patients kind of tickle their skin a little bit.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. It's interesting. This is something that I've always, thought maybe this is different in between patients when it comes to like dermatome sensitivity. But I hate injecting in my quads because, you try to do a leg day after that, or like just go up and down the stairs and it's brutal. And so, injecting in the glute is a lot easier. It's a lot safer. God forbid you have a bad injection reaction or something like that. But one thing that you'll always see in all of the textbooks and online, guides is doing a like a very high lateral, glute injection. And I think that they do that simply because that's just more accessible. But I found that more of like a ventromedial one is a lot less painful for me. And so that's, kind of what I do. Which I'm sure looks really amusing to any of my children, should they, God forbid, walk in on me in the bathroom. But it's fine. There's no shame in our family.
Yeah, it's interesting because we teach most of our patients to do a quad injection.
Oh yeah, I know. And quads are so painful. And so, granted, it all depends on the patient's flexibility and their comfort level and that sort of thing. But for my younger patients, again, especially if you're using larger, amounts of oil, like, oh my gosh, glutes so much easier.
Yeah. So I've had some patients say, well, how do I know if I'm in muscle or fat? And does it matter?
So number one, doesn't matter, okay, because we know the sub-Q is fine. All right. Number two, okay, I will tell you, especially whenever you're like dealing with like the glute, okay, or the leg, you freaking feel it, because I'm like my muscle spasms whenever I enter it. Like I know I'm in muscle because all of a sudden things get twitchy. And not that I recommend doing this, but if you start to try and like move the needle back and forth, like whenever it's in sub-Q, you can rock that thing back and forth, but when you get into muscle, it is stuck. And so that's, I tell patients that you want, it's that second pop of resistance, because you have that initial resistance whenever you're getting through the skin, and you know when that is. And then you'll have a next little bit of increase in resistance, and you know you're deep enough because you'll feel your muscle like twitch.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So the other thing I've heard from some patients is when I send in the prescription, which it's written at, in the name as an intramuscular injection, but I write for subcutaneous, some pharmacies will not fill the prescription if I write it for sub-Q. I don't know if you've had that experience as well.
Oh, I've had every excuse imaginable. I've had some pharmacies, you know, call, pharmacists call, like, you know, ranting and raving because I'm trying to kill a patient because I put them on daily Cialis with a booster sildenafil. And I'm like, bro, you've never tried it? You're missing out. Unfortunately, pharmacists have a tough job. They have to try and keep a million different interactions and things memorized. They don't get to know the nuances of any individual drug, and they have a brutal schedule to keep up, especially in, you know, corporate pharmacies. So I just smile, nod. My nurses will adjust a script if they need to, or more commonly, we've moved to a point where we are using mostly compounding pharmacies because those are usually specialized. They have more experience. Their pharmacists know what they're talking about. And because it's cash, we don't have to worry about prior authorizations. Patients get competitive pricing and, you know, everyone gets fewer phone calls.
And then the last question I have related to injections is, so I only use cypionate in my practice. When would you use enanthate?
So I like enanthate because it has a slightly shorter half-life. Some people who are very lean might notice a difference in water retention as a result of that, because it all has to do with the length of the ester. And so if you're looking at it, testosterone actually comes in a lot of different forms. So the shortest ester is no ester. That's just straight up testosterone suspension, which I don't think that you're going to find, you know, in any pharmacy, okay, because it's in and out of the system. That's usually a performance enhancement that guys will use during a power or lifting meet. Then you've got testosterone propionate, which is going to be the shortest ester. That stuff is on and off in just a day and a half. So it is very quick on and quick off. Burns a little bit, but again, has the least amount of water retention with it. Not a lot of application for regular TRT, at least for most people. Then you start to get into enanthate, next largest, then dicyprianate. And then we get into like the more or the less common things like testosterone undecanoate, injectable testosterone undecanoate. That is the longest ester. And that is, you know, commonly known as AV. That's a commercial name here in the United States. And then, you know, there are a bunch of other, you know, esters that have been added to testosterone historically, but those are just the ones that we commonly encounter. So in my practice, I prescribe mostly cypionate with enanthate, maybe for my younger patients that are more sensitive to, you know, feeling puffy or bloated.
Mm-hmm. So I oftentimes ask my patients if they feel like they're retaining water. A lot of people don't know. Is that an obvious feeling?
Well, I can tell in myself, and, you know, it's something that we showed in Larry's clinic. He had a in-body or a body mass, you know, calculating machine that we actually used, and we were able to tell that, yeah, patients do retain water and they hold water weight whenever you start them on an injectable, you know, testosterone depot shot. You know, at the time we didn't have a large enough sample size to show a significant difference between enanthate and cypionate, which makes sense. You know, the half-life is only maybe better or shorter on enanthate by about a day. You'd have to have a pretty large sample size in order to suss that out. But I will tell you that more frequent injections, with a shorter ester are usually going to result in much less fluid retention.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you bring that up because in my clinic, we have a bioimpedance scale. And so for a lot of the patients that I share with my sister, she'll get them on the scale before I see them. She'll tell me if they're up in their water weight. I agree. Having that objective information is so valuable to know what's happening with their body composition.
Yeah, it was. It's really, really cool, and it helps give you more insight, right? Because, you know, patients will get really nervous because what I've seen happen with some guys is they will start on testosterone. They're like, "Oh my gosh, you know, I'm gaining weight. This isn't what I wanted to do." And then you look at their face, and you know, you put them on an impedance scale, and you're like, "Bro, you just put on, you know, an extra like 2 or 3 pounds of water weight. Like, you know, this is nothing to sweat about. You have not added fat. You've actually added lean mass and water. Okay." Those are all good things. All right. We can work on your total poundage later.
So you briefly mentioned the role of things like anastrozole, and you mentioned, you know, the role of estradiol and the importance in the body. I've seen guys where we're running their estrogen level a bit on the higher side, and that's why they're retaining water. So how do you know if like some of that water retention or edema is from estrogen or the ester in the medication?
Yeah, I mean, it's anyone's guess, right? They're both variables that can contribute to it. I tend to be more comfortable running estrogen a little high as opposed to running it too low. Because whenever you run estrogen super low, you run into some not good side effects. When in reality, to get the side effects of excess estrogen, it really needs to be pretty darn high for a significant period of time. So running guys a little rich is not a bad thing when it comes to their estrogen. So it's rare that I meet a patient who ever has the complaint of water retention. Most guys don't notice it.
Yeah. And that's actually what I've learned a lot from listening to Dr. Morgenthaler's content is his take on estrogen. I used to be a lot more aggressive with treating elevated estrogen levels, and now I really only treat it in the setting of symptoms.
Yeah, that is a very valid approach. You know, I will tell you that whenever we start to get to like, you know, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I'll start to think about adding in a tiny dab of anastrozole.
I agree. I do it when it gets that high. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's when I start to worry about some of my patients that are on planes for prolonged periods of time, you know, have a lot of time of venous stasis. We don't want to put them at an increased risk of, you know, a PE or, you know, a VTE. Because if you look at the TRAVERSE trial, we did not see any increased risk of cardiac events, but there was an increased risk potentially in VTEs, although it was a little controversial. And also, we have to understand that with TRAVERSE, we're dealing with essentially like TRT light. Like TRAVERSE was like low dose topical, and we're talking about like healthy doses of, you know, depo testosterone, which is a totally different animal.
And that's what I explain to my patients is, yes, the TRAVERSE trial was a landmark study, but they used a formulation that I rarely use in clinical practice. And so the question becomes, can we say that the, you know, no increased risk compared to placebo of topical testosterone in terms of major cardiac events, can we say that that is the same case when we're talking about higher doses of injectable testosterone?
Yeah. And the answer is like, yeah, they're not comparable at all.
Yeah.
And so like I've sat and listened to some, you know, people that are probably like, you know, pound for pound smarter than I am as far as raw compute power goes, you know, stand up at maybe one of our lectures and say, testosterone is not cardiotoxic and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, bro, you're just not taking enough because, you know, I have seen firsthand what it looks like when you start to dose guys with really high doses of, let's say 300 a week, 400, 500, 800, a gram. Okay. Yeah. What happens is that you really affect hepatic metabolism of your lipids, and you will see HDL get driven through the floor. LDL goes through the roof. Okay. And you end up getting really deleterious changes that all point towards plaque formation. All right. And all point towards cardiomegaly. All right. Your heart, newsflash, it's a muscle. Okay. And if you're taking enough testosterone to cause systemic hypertrophy of your muscles, right, to that degree, well, your heart's probably going to respond too. And that's also another thing that I think is lost on the bodybuilding and fitness community, right? Everyone's like, bro, I get my blood work checked. No, I'm good. And the truth is that whenever you're dealing with super physiologic doses of testosterone, blood work alone doesn't cut it, right? You also have to get organ imaging on top of that because you need to see, like, what is your ejection fraction looking like? Are you starting to develop any sort of nodularity or changes in the echogenicity of your liver? Okay. Like, you know, you say that your creatinine is, you know, elevated because you've got, you know, I don't know, big muscles, which happens all the time. But what about a cystatin C? Are we actually calculating what your estimated GFR is over time? Or are you just saying, oh, it's all fine? So there's a lot of nuance there that I think is lost by most people.
I think the point in our favor of the testosterone cypionate is it's been around for like 50 years. So at the standard clinical doses that we use, if there were an increased risk for a major cardiac event, we probably would have seen it by now.
Probably, right? You know, that goes back to just, you know, like people ask, where's the evidence? I ask them, well, where are the bodies? Right? Because, I mean, truthfully, with as much testosterone as I prescribe, you know, in the Indianapolis area, not just for myself, I have four amazing PAs who, you know, all work, you know, under my license. You know, if there was a problem, we would have seen it just in our neighborhood alone. And, you know, that hasn't happened. So, you know, again, testosterone appears to be totally safe when monitored by a qualified provider at physiologic clinical doses. But, you know, that's all we can say. Mm-hmm. Outside of that,
Let's touch on the lipid profile here a little bit. At what dose of, let's say, testosterone cypionate would you start regularly checking someone's lipid panel?
So,
because that's not in our AUA guidelines.
Yeah. And that's because, you know, typically I think that the people that make the guidelines, you know, they're not cardiologists and they were never trained to look at it. Okay. And so it's just never become part of regular clinical practice. But, you know, as you've learned, Amy, a lot of times when patients are coming to see us to talk about TRT, we may be the only doctor that they're seeing. And, you know, like I tell patients, I want you to live an awesome life, but I want you to live it for a long time. And so I think it is very reasonable if a man is not established with a primary care provider, regardless of what their testosterone is, I think it's reasonable to check their lipids. And even if you're not going to treat that because we don't receive adequate training when it comes to statin management or Zetia or, you know, looking at ApoB and a lot of other these, you know, critical biomarkers, you know, that can be the nudge that patients get to go see a cardiologist and to get them referred. So I think that is worthwhile. And I will tell you just from clinical experience, once you start to go above 150 milligrams a week of testosterone cypionate, that's where you might start to see changes in lipids. And so again, patient hasn't had them in a while, you know, good to go ahead and check. Doesn't mean that you necessarily need to change your dosing, but it does mean that if the patient has, you know, an HDL of like, you know, freaking 15, you know, and an LDL that's, you know, through the roof, hey, maybe we get that guy referred to a cardiologist.
Yeah, I'm like you. I'm oftentimes the first person that's offered an advanced lipid panel for my patients. And then if I see something that's abnormal, I'm the first person to ask, do you want to see a preventative cardiologist?
Yeah. And, you know, again, you know, those coronary calcium CT scans are, they're not perfect, but they're cheap. And, you know, I tell patients, don't treat it as like a continuum. It's a yes or no test. And if the test comes back as a yes, then brother, we're getting you a stress test because I have a number of patients that come into my practice that have had a prior exogenous, you know, steroid exposure. And, you know, yeah, they come in with very legit low testosterone. They deserve to be treated. But, you know, if they've been taking especially a lot of oral anabolics over a prolonged period of time, I mean, they could be a time bomb waiting to happen and no one's ever bothered to check their heart.
Mm. So we briefly discussed the TRAVERSE trial, which used topical testosterone. So I think that's the next best place to go in terms of formulations.
Sure.
When I was starting off at the University of Iowa, I actually didn't have much experience with topical formulations or really with testosterone in general. And because I was directing the men's health service line, I knew people were going to come to me expecting that I was the expert. And so I realized that the best way for me to gain as much clinical experience as possible was to go where they tell us not to go. Facebook. And I joined a closed testosterone replacement therapy support group that had over 10,000 members. And I could read posts for men and women all over the world in even just a couple of minutes. And I gathered what worked and didn't work for patients. I got the clinical information that would have taken me decades to learn in a clinical practice.
Yeah.
What I learned from reading a lot of those posts is that I got the sense that a lot of men did not like the topicals, that they didn't absorb the medication, that they didn't feel symptomatic improvement. And yet topicals are very popular therapies. I'd love your take on topical formulations for T.
Yeah, so topicals are probably more popular with providers than they are with patients, just because you don't have to worry about all the nuances with injecting. Incidence of elevated estrogens and hematocrits, you know, polycythemia is much lower. Okay. But the problem is that, you know, the best product, you know, that we ever had for topical testosterone that actually had decent penetrance was something called Testim, which isn't even on the market anymore. And so the ability to get a quality, reliable topical that has a more uniform penetrance is really, really challenging. And as a result, in our practice, we have moved for topicals exclusively to a local compounding pharmacy's topical cream, mostly because that way we have a standard that we can compare because we're not switching up to different formulations, different gels, you know, constantly. And, you know, they're very progressive as far as compounding a pretty decent dose, 200 milligrams per milliliter of click. But that's what patients need in order to get decent absorption. And so that's probably why topicals have gotten popular in the past, but why patients, you know, maybe don't feel so great on them because of low penetrance.
What percentage of your patients do you think you have on topicals?
Oh gosh, not many, you know, maybe 5-10% at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, what really has become the majority of our business, testosterone cypionate is still the most widely prescribed, you know, agent for us. But the introduction of oral testosterone, again, disclaimer, you know, I am a consultant for Marius Pharmaceuticals, which makes Kysotrex. But the introduction of oral testosterone in our practice has really been a positive change for patients. And that's probably our second most common agent now after injectables.
And have you found that people tend to like taking pills better than the injections? You know, in my practice, I'll ask people, how do you feel about taking pills twice a day? Like, that's the one type of patient that I would say you're not a candidate for the orals. Like, if they're not going to remember to take their medication twice a day, they're just not going to benefit from the medication. Is that what you've heard from your patients as well?
I have. And it's funny because some patients, like, they're like, oh my gosh, anything to avoid a shot. And other people are like, oh yeah, the shot's easy. I just do it once a week. You want me to do a pill twice a day? Take a hike. And what's also been nice is whenever I talk about orals now, it actually lets me kind of hold some of my patients accountable when it comes to the other medications. Because I've had some guy be like, I can't remember to take a pill every day. I'm like, well, you're apparently on 2 or 3 different oral agents for your diabetes and your A1C is like 9. So let's talk about that, you know. And, you know, because I am, you know, an old man, you know, by many standards now, like I have a weekly pill box that I prep once a week. You know, and I tell patients, and I'm like, all right, so you're here to see me because you have low testosterone and your penis doesn't work. All right, probably related to the diabetes that you haven't bothered to address in about 15 years. And you're telling me that you can't even take a pill? Like, brother, we've got some work to do here. Like, if you want me to do the work of creating a regimen for you and trying to guide you through it, you have to do the work of actually sticking with it. And so, yeah, listen. Is testosterone going to maybe help your A1C? Is testosterone going to help your body composition? Yeah, but so are your diabetic meds. So why don't we do both?
Mm-hmm. So a new patient comes in who, let's say, is testosterone naive.
Yep.
Where do you typically start them? Like, in my practice, I'll talk to them about all the different options. But like your practice, I'm typically using the oral medications or the injections.
Yeah. For me, I go straight to orals or injectables just because, you know, I do not feel that a topical is going to be a superior product for the majority of patients, except for my elderly, more frail gentlemen that have a problem with dexterity and also may not have the ability to take a medicine with food on a regular basis. And so really, you know, what I tell patients is, as of right now, like the latest and greatest is oral testosterone, simply because it's the latest thing to the market and it has the lowest incidence of increased red blood cell count and hyperestrogenism. So, all right, great. Problem is that at least the way that we provide it in our practice, it's not covered by insurance. All right. And so it's going to cost you an expensive Starbucks habit, you know? So in our practice, it's $160 a month. And I tell patients, listen, for some people in my practice, that is an ungodly amount of money. For some people, they spend more than that at Starbucks every single month. And so it's not a big deal. And then the second question I ask is, all right, so that's talking about price, but, you know, what seems more convenient to you? Are you okay doing shots? Some people are, you know, doing Ozempic and they're used to having a needle poke their skin. Doesn't bother them. Other people, totally foreign concept. So I kind of use patient preference to direct me. And in any case, we're going to, you know, always have updated labs when I meet them. in order to confirm the diagnosis and move forward. I will frequently get testosterone, estrogen, hematocrit, PSA, if they're of an appropriate age, and we've discussed prostate cancer screening. And then in my practice, I also get prolactin per guidelines to rule out a prolactinoma. And although not indicate or not mandated, I do often get LH and FSH because I do have a unique fertility aspect of my practice, and we'll grab those, you know, as a result as well. I've diagnosed Klinefelter syndrome in young men coming in complaining of low testosterone who have an FSH through the frickin' roof, and you know they still wanted to have kids at a later date. So I find having that valuable in my situation. But we get those baseline labs, you know, go ahead, get guys started on their regimen, and it usually takes them a week or two to get the meds, get on the meds, and then I will see them back 6 weeks after our initial visit with labs a couple of days ahead of time. And that's usually enough time for them to have a handle on symptomatic improvement. We can see how their hormones are doing and just do a quick check-in. And after that, we'll start to move to Q3 months and then Q6 months because testosterone is a Schedule 3 substance. You got to see patients at least once every 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I have a very similar practice as you do. Now, I just want to briefly touch on some of the remaining formulations of testosterone. I know you've had some experience with intranasal testosterone. Would love to get your thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah, it's awful. I 0 out of 10 would not recommend. Well, I mean, it's just, it's very greasy. You know, as someone who's like struggled with like, you know, acne and rosacea my entire life, the idea of introducing more oil into my face seems absolutely detestable. You know, and honestly, like the market is the great, you know, arbiter of success and failure. There's a reason why, you know, Natesto is no longer readily available, man. Like that stuff crashed and burned. Trust me, if it was great, then, you know, it would have taken off and it would have been a lot more popular than it was. But 3 times a day intranasal testosterone, no thanks.
Yeah, 3 times a day is tough. And I've heard similar reports from patients in terms of the oil in their face.
Yeah, it's what's funny is that it actually has some interesting uses. It's a fun little boost if you want to take it before intimacy, like with a partner. It kind of revs up libido. It's great for females for that use too, because it's so short acting, you're never going to get any virilization. So it can just kind of give you that little boost or oomph, you know, before date night. And, you know, it's also been used in the training, you know, context to, again, have that momentary spike in testosterone before you go to the gym. And, you know, works good for that. But as something you actually use day to day for testosterone management, never.
Mm-hmm. What about the role for subcutaneous auto injection?
Yeah, you know, Xiastead, you know, the one thing that I like about Xiastead is that it just brings testosterone and anthate into the conversation a little bit more. But, you know, I'm a very cheap human being. And so when I look at the cost of Xiastead, hundreds and hundreds of dollars for that little bit of, you know, plastic, which again, it's a fancy bit of plastic. And I have used Xiastead like personally. And most of the time I'm like, where'd the oil go? Cause I didn't feel a thing. Right. But the thing is that its max dose is 100 milligrams. So that doesn't really help me for my younger patients that may or may not need a slightly higher dose. And also, like, we have a strict policy in my clinic that we don't do prior authorizations. Okay. I refuse to do extra work on behalf of a pharmaceutical company or on behalf of an insurance company. And unfortunately, that has become commonplace in many different corners of medicine. But because we have really good affordable cash options in the world of testosterone replacement therapy that are in fact the gold standards, if we're talking about injectables and orals, then, you know, why would, even for topicals, we have compounded options. You know, why would I subject my nurses to pulling their hair out, doing an hour-long prior authorization for every single testosterone patient that comes through our door when you think that we're seeing 160 patients, 200 patients a day in between me and all my PAs? No, thanks.
Yeah. Well, and to go back to earlier in our discussion, we were talking about with appropriate injection technique, you can inject yourself not using an auto injector and it can be comfortable. And I think that's where that technique is really important to give people a cost-effective option, doesn't require prior authorization, and you're still getting the same medication.
Yeah. And if you're getting to the point where like you can't bother to learn how like the proper injection and you need something, you know, convenient, well, okay, that's, you're going to pay for that convenience. Mm-hmm. It's called oral testosterone. Mm-hmm. So
last one I want to touch on here is our testosterone pellets. lots of clinics offering pellets. You know, I saw a urologist do pellets when I was in training, but then for most of my training, it wasn't something that we offered. I had a patient in my current practice want it, so I did the procedure. I have very mixed feelings about pellets. Would love to get your opinion.
Yeah, you know, pellets are fine. You know, pellets had their day in the sun back whenever it was, you know, reimbursed at a very high rate. And so you could put in a lot of pellets. You know, you could purchase the drug and you can make a profit off of it, off the drug itself. And so what happened is you actually had these pellet mills that started popping up. And these were not even urologists, not even endocrinologists, but these were just anybody with a license to prescribe anything, you know, realizing an opportunity for profit. And they were just shoving pellets in everyone. And the problem with that approach is that you can't tweak or titrate anything. And so what you've got is what you've got, man. We can't dig those out of your butt. You do start to accumulate scar tissue in the subcutaneous fat as time goes on. I often joke that your butt will look like a gravel road if you give me enough time and enough, you know, attempts at it. And, you know, our options for dosing have been severely curtailed due to abuse by the system. So now it's really difficult to get more than 6 pellets. You know, you can get that with Medicare. Commercial insurance, it's tricky, man. And so as a result, you know, pellets have kind of fallen off and they're persistent, especially now that we've got compounded pellet options that a lot of cash TRT clinics will offer. And I think they have a place. I really like them for, again, our elderly patients. You know, you get that guy who's like, hey, topicals don't work for me. I can't figure out injections or they're annoying. All right. And I can't afford freaking oral. Right. So that's a guy where I'm like, all right, you're going to get your Medicare 6 pellets. And in our practice, our PAs do a great job. And so that's, you know, those are the patients we have on Testapel or testosterone pellets, but it's not a lot.
Yeah. And it's always in the context of the, bioidentical hormone conversation that pellets come up. I can't tell you how many men, I'm sure you've seen the same thing where they come in and they say, doc, I want the bioidentical hormone pellets. I want the good stuff. And I'm like, everything I have to offer is bioidentical.
Yeah, we don't have any horse testosterone. I have some of my bodybuilder patients that I'm sure would love horse testosterone if I could get it for them. It's just not a thing. You know, the whole term bioidentical is because, you know, there are multiple estrogens, all right? It's not just a single compound. So the problem was, is that we were getting like porcine or equine, you know, estrogens, and we were giving those to women. And so it really did make a difference whenever we transitioned to giving true, like Homo sapien, you know, people estrogen, you know, back to females. And then that term just got co-opted. And now we have this issue of like bioidentical testosterone, which isn't a thing because all testosterone is bioidentical, just whether or not it's got an ester on it. How long does it last? What's the PK curve look like? And I share your frustration. Although I do need to shout out to my friend Andrew Sun, who's trying to redefine bioidentical testosterone and use that for oral testosterone because it follows that sort of diurnal pattern that, you know, we don't get with any other testosterone formulation, which I find interesting. There's a whole discussion we could have about androgen receptor sensitivity and expression. I think that whenever we dose people on cypionate, they get that initial high where they feel amazing for the first few weeks and then it tapers off. And the only thing that makes sense to me is, you know, downregulation of androgen receptors because they're getting the same serum results of testosterone. So, you know, is there a way that we can avoid that by potentially either taking people off of testosterone for a break or moving them onto something like an oral where they'll actually have a dip and their body can actually recover? And it's interesting because I have patients on oral testosterone and on a SERM like enclomiphene, and they're maintaining gonadotropins at really high, healthy levels, and they're not getting any testicular atrophy. They're maintaining their semen analyses. And so there's a lot of interesting nuance there that is fun to play with.
Awesome. Alex, what is your message for urologists who are early on in their practice when it comes to them understanding their role in the testosterone space?
You know, the best advice that I would give you is like seek to invest in your own education, because this is something that is not going away. This is something that is becoming increasingly expected of us as providers. And the truth is that as urologists, we are encountering men as they are starting to get to the age where they need to start going to the doctor. So believe it or not, you know, just like OBGYNs have long been the first line of defense for their female patients, we are becoming the first line of defense for our male patients. And so if you haven't gotten that education in your residency, shout out, I didn't get it either. All right. You know, I would encourage you to join the SMSNA, you know, to join the Androgen Society started by Dr., you know, Abe Morgenthaler, and start to try and reach out, you know, to colleagues and peers. You know, the majority of my, you know, social media content now is, you know, directed around either androgen replacement or penile implants. And so I think that this is something that if you put the time in, not only are your patients going to benefit because they're going to get better care, but you're going to have a much better time in practice because you're going to be speaking from a place of authority and you're going to look forward to these visits and you're going to look forward to these high fives rather than, you know, that experience we all had at the VA where we were dreading that testosterone, you know, consult because we didn't know what the heck we were doing.
So when I was reviewing the TRT support group thread, a common question that I saw being asked was who's the best provider to see for hormone replacement. It was who was the worst provider to see, a primary care doctor, an endocrinologist, or a urologist. And I think because we're not really trained in hormones and we haven't addressed it for so long, we've kind of told our middle-aged men, like, you know, oh, it's middle age. This is just what it is. So just like sort of like suffer through it. This is what it means to be getting older. And they've lost trust in us. And so I think in terms of when we speak about this conversation of like people losing trust in the healthcare system, if we learn how to treat both men and women with their hormone issues, that's one way for us to regain trust.
Yeah, I think you've got a great point there. And to everyone that says that it's just natural, I'm like, well, if you've ever played the Oregon Trail, we know what's natural is dying of dysentery trying to ford a river. But fortunately, we have indoor plumbing now. We have, you know, modern sanitation, and we also have modern medicine to help us live fuller, more healthy lives. So how about we just do a better job of understanding and utilizing the medicine we've got?
Dr. Tatum, that is such a great way to end this podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Amy. I appreciate it.